Okay, so tonight we're continuing with our foundational Buddhist teachings series, and tonight is on karma, the law of moral cause and effect. So, you know, the gist of this is, how should we behave? And in the Buddhist sense, we talk about behavior of behavior through body, speech, and mind. So it's our physical actions, it's our speech, but it's also our mental activity, you know, because as you know, if you continually think a particular thought, it's going to condition your actions, it's going to affect the kinds of thoughts that you have in the future. So even the kinds of thoughts that we entertain, the way that we direct our mind, creates karma, creates results. So how can we behave in order to minimize suffering for self and other, and to maximize happiness and peace for self and other? And essentially, you know, this, the question of karma, how could you, what in your behavior could affect the future, could affect your future conditions and your future experience and your future happiness, was a big question at the Buddha's time. And all the different spiritual traditions had their own take on this. And essentially, I mean, if you think about this question, you try to make it relevant for yourself. In terms of our everyday experience, it's really that question of, you know, how much control do we have over our behavior, in a way? I mean, sometimes we feel like we have control over it. Sometimes we feel like we have very little control over it. Like, and how much of it is just conditioned? I mean, we have all these experiences, all this conditioning, all these habits, and you know, how much of what we're doing is just the continuation of that momentum, and how much is a choice. So sometimes it can feel like there's not a lot of opportunity for input. And to get kind of philosophical about it, you know, Western philosophers also question this. Do we have essentially free will? From the Buddhist point of view, it's like there is a lot of, you know, this flow of karma, cause from past causes and conditions are affecting what's happening right now, but that we have input into the process. So we can't, you know, maybe it's kind of, think of it like a big ship that's going in a direction. You can't just completely change the direction of the ship. I mean, there's like karmic momentum bringing in a certain direction, and yet we can steer. We can make choices that in this moment that change things. And also there's what we find when we look really closely is there is a moment of complete freedom, a point of complete freedom in this moment. Most of the time we don't notice it. We kind of just, you know, steamroll through it, driven by our habit energies or our desires. But if we cultivate the intention and we cultivate the mindfulness to pay attention, we do have that moment, you know, I do not have to say that thing. I do not have to, you know, eat that thing. I do not have to, you know, make that choice again. I can do something else. Actually, I had a conversation today for about an hour with a guy who's writing a book, and he's interviewing a bunch of different Zen teachers. And in particular, he's going to get around to asking about kind of like social justice, environmental justice, and how do I see how that fits in with Zen practice and stuff? And he's asking this of different people. But today he was just kind of asking, getting the biography, and he asked me, you know, why because I said I had been feeling a lot of desperation when I was in my mid-20s, that it just, I had no choice. I was living in these dysfunctional ways, and there was really nothing I could do about it. Even though I wanted to live differently or act differently or respond to my partner differently, I just couldn't bring myself to do it, and I felt very disempowered. And then when I discovered Zen, I had quite a honeymoon period of just somehow the tools of practice, the meditation, the mindfulness, it started to open things up, and I could notice that moment of choice. I could see, like, all right, here we're going down this karmic path, you know, this dance with my partner at the time, and was like, oh, I know where this goes. I can do something different. And that was just like amazingly radical to me. That was just so cool. So there's that sense that, I mean, sometimes we miss it, but that ultimately we do have that freedom. We do have complete freedom in this moment. So karma may be the Buddhist concept most widely mentioned and perhaps arguably most widely misunderstood outside Buddhist circles. You know, people will say, well, that's karma, when somebody gets their comeuppance. Well, that's karma for you. So in other words, there's this sense that even if you're operating in secret, each of us is subject to some kind of moral tally. You know, either there's a deity up in the sky keeping track of it, or there's some kind of natural law, but there's a tally, and you've got, you know, X marks in this column, and you're going to have to pay. So you may appear to get away with doing something selfish or harmful, but you can't escape the negative results of your actions forever. And also included in this popular understanding is that it often operates in like a beautifully ironic or poetic way, such as when somebody's made a habit of cheating people, ends up losing their own savings, you know, something like that. And this comeuppance view of karma isn't entirely off base. So the Buddhist view of karma is kind of a natural law of moral cause and effect. And it means you ultimately can't get away with something, even if it appears like you are, or appears like you're not being caught, etc. But it also means everything, and so this is what the popular conception misses, everything you do has some kind of effect. Every single thing you do, no matter how small, has some kind of effect. It's pretty obvious when you think about it. And so you'd better be careful, think carefully about what kind of results you want. You know, what is going to be the effects of what you're doing. So karma in Buddhism is also quite subtle, rather than being a simplistic system of reward and punishment. It's about the state of your mind when you form an intention to act, the state of your mind when you perform the action, and the state of your mind when you experience the consequences. All of that feeds into how things are. So I say the law, I call it the law of moral cause and effect, because karma is specifically about causal relationships between our behavior and the consequences in our life and experience. So there are many different causal forces in the world, physical, chemical, biological, social, cultural, economic. But karma is the causal force of like individual human action, and in particular, individual human choices and deliberate action. So karma is not about luck or fate. And also I call it a moral law in the sense that karma is concerned with principles of right or wrong behavior, and that's the definition of moral. Now, in Buddhism, the terms right and wrong, it isn't about some kind of determined system of morality, divinely given system of morality, but it's a pragmatic observation, you know, what results in suffering and what results in liberation or happiness. So what's right or appropriate is what leads to greater happiness, and what is wrong or unskillful leads to suffering. So in the Buddha's time, that question arose in this great drama called human life. What is the connection between our behavior and our relative happiness or misery? And then, of course, in his time, and in some forms of Buddhism still, they see this as, they ascribe to the theory of transmigration, so that this isn't your only lifetime. You've had multiple lifetimes, you know, infinite many lifetimes before. You have infinitely more later. And so something that you do in this lifetime can then affect what happens to you in a future lifetime. And I will just confess in a way that there are some forms of Buddhism, certainly other forms of religion, particularly Indian religions, and certain forms of Buddhism, including some of the forms of Vajrayana Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, teach that everything that happens to you is due to karma. Everything. Like if you, the fact that you discovered Right Way Zen is because of something that you did, you know, in a past life. Or I think that's a weird and creepy belief. I mean, obviously you just have to agree to disagree, you know. Maybe you like that idea of transmigration yourself, but for me, I see two reasons why people would want to stick to that idea. That this is everything that has happening to us is due to karma. And one, it can be a way to blame people for their own unfortunate circumstances. Therefore, I'm not responsible for helping them, because whatever is happening to them is due to their past actions. And they can just, you know, act differently now, and hopefully their future will be better. And I mean, that's not an exaggeration. Like, you know, that's part of the thinking behind the Indian caste system, is that, you know, previous life, you were born into this lower caste, and if you just do your time now, you know, might have better luck next time. So there's that aspect. And then the second is a little more subtle, and I think sometimes it's easier to blame ourselves. It's more attractive to blame ourselves for our circumstances and experience than to accept that life can be random and out of our control. Like if I get cancer and I say, well, you know, that's just because it's the, you know, ripening of my karma, then I can kind of think, well, now I will act in such a way that I won't get cancer in some future existence. I have some control over this, as opposed to, you know, just completely it's out of your hands. There's nothing that you could do. That's kind of a scary, terrifying thought, is that this, you know, tragedy and misfortune can just fall upon us at any time, and there's nothing that we can do about it. So anyway, that's just kind of a digression, because it's certainly not the way that we approach karma in Zen and most forms of Buddhism, but just to be aware that there are some forms of Buddhism that really take that very, very literally, that everything is due to karma. We tend to see it more as just, you know, it's one of many causes. But it's perhaps more of a significant cause of our condition than we sometimes think, And I think many of us, as we get older, appreciate how that is so. How all of our habits, our habit of sitting like this, now we've got back problems, right? I mean, every small thing that we do, and then it adds up over time, and it really, it has its repercussions. So, you know, indulged anger over little things, well, now that's a really well-worn habit. So, you know, our, and then at the same time, then of course, I'll get to the karma of practice in a little bit. Because at the same time, we can practice other kinds of things, form new habits, and that can actually be a fairly positive cumulative effect. So, feel free to jump in with questions along the way if anybody has any.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
You're mentioning that some souls of Buddhism, they say everything that happens is due to karma, but wouldn't that eliminate the possibility for free will? I mean, everything that happens, and like, almost what happened to you in a past life, but then in your past life, that would have been due to some other past life. And so if karma is terminating everything, then you have no...
Well, they still believe that there's the freedom of this. Like, in this moment, you can make a different choice that will then, you know, have effects on your future.
Isn't there kind of the point that what happens is karma, how you react is yourself? I mean, you have a choice in this life, how you react to the things that are a result of your past lives.
I do tend to think of karma as in my past.
Well, we have a responsibility for generating what kind of karma we're generating now.
Yeah.
So that's really, you know, behind the whole path. So there are, there's two different, positive karma. Well, he said there were four kinds. Positive karma that leads to positive results. Negative karma that leads to negative results. Mixed karma that leads to mixed results, which is probably most of our actions. And then karma that leads to the end of karma. Karma that leads to liberation. So essentially that's that our spiritual practice is leading to the end of the generation of causes and conditions that keep this whole process going, the whole samsaric process going. So in a way, the positive karma that leads to positive results in the metaphor, if you will, of transmigration, then you're talking about, you know, having a good rebirth. You know, within the context of this life, maybe, you know, you're happier or you're more at peace or you're whatever. So it leads to kind of worldly positive results. But, you know, from the Buddhist point of view, all conditioned things come to an end. And so kind of creating worldly happiness is fine, but it's of a limited, it's not going to last. And so there's a greater... something greater to seek for, which is, you know, real spiritual peace and liberation. So that's what that fourth kind of karma leads us to, you know, so we're not dependent on our positive circumstances. We're not dependent on a positive rebirth. And of course, in the metaphor of transmigration, ultimately we would just not be reborn. We'd just not be pulled forward in this whole process. But this all might become a little bit more clear as I have these three kind of little story examples. So to illustrate that karma isn't as simple as do X and Y will happen. So there were some spiritual traditions that did that. Like, you know, if you step on a bug, then, you know, in a future life, you will have ugly ears. I don't know. Like, I mean, like, really, there were traditions that were that specific about what the, you know, people just have a lot of time, right? And they speculate about all the things that might happen based on, if you do this thing, then that'll happen. So, yeah, sure, there are general karmic patterns, but from the, in the Buddhist point of view, we see it as much more complex. So we do X, and what happens next will depend on what you've done in the past that made it likely you would do X, the clarity of your perception when you chose to do X, your intention when you did X, the quality of your attention when you did X. And in addition, whatever happens as a result of X, your experience of that result will be influenced by how you view yourself, how you view the whole situation, your intentions for the future. It's all much, much more complex than just, you know, one thing follows the other. So I have three scenarios to illustrate this, some of this complexity. So let's say Doug works in the financial sector and has the opportunity to make a lot of money by doing something shady and illegal. This maneuver will deplete the pensions of a bunch of people. In scenario one, Doug has nurtured resentment against people who have more money than he does, and he feels he deserves more wealth. Part of him knows it's wrong to steal, but he talks to some like-minded friends who help convince him to do it. Amazingly, once the act is completed, he isn't caught. However, forever after, Doug feels a certain level of stress about the deep, dark secret behind his improved financial situation. It makes it difficult to trust people because he never knows what their reaction would be if they knew. After a few years, he ends up with stress-related health issues. He continues to justify his theft internally because it would be too overwhelming to consider regret. So when he gets the chance to profit from another shady maneuver, he goes ahead and does it again. This time he gets caught and ends up in jail. In scenario two, Doug is faced with the same opportunity to make money from an illegal financial maneuver, and he still resents people with wealth and feels he deserves more of it. He knows it's wrong to steal. So he appeases his nagging conscience by talking to a couple friends who do their best to live moral, honest lives. They ask him some hard questions and discourage him from going through with his plan. However, he can't overcome the temptation and does it anyway. Afterwards, he isn't caught, but something isn't right. He feels stressed, suspicious, and secretive. He explores his feelings and subsequent health issues through therapy and mindfulness practice. He decides the costs are too high to confess his crime and face the consequences, but he opens himself up to regret and finds some way to make amends with his ill-gotten gains. He still carries the shame of his past action, but has also learned a lot from it. In scenario three, Doug notices how he envies the wealth of others and tends to dwell on a sense of lack in his life. It's difficult, but he gradually explores his feelings and assumptions through spiritual practice. Over time, he gains more and more personal conviction that the best things in life are not those obtained with money. When Doug is faced with the opportunity to make a bunch of cash through an illegal financial deal, he isn't even tempted to sacrifice his peace of mind by doing it, and instead thinks with sympathy of the people who would stand a chance of being swindled out of their pension funds. So, hopefully this illustrates that there are all kinds of ways that we have that kind of moment of freedom to make a different choice in the moment, but that's not the only input into the system. Like, our whole practice and how we frame our whole lives, you know, enters into this whole karmic situation. So the decisions that we make to cultivate positive friendships or to, you know, build up a habit of meditation and mindfulness, you know, a determination to face our crap and, you know, be honest with ourselves and, you know, work through it, to take responsibility, to do things now that will set us up to make the best possible choices in a given circumstance. Relate, you know, forming those relationships with good people who share our aspirations will give us positive, you know, because we can pretty much always find, if we really want to do something, we can find somebody we can talk to who's going to encourage us to do it. And then we have other people that we know might go, and, you know, who are we going to seek out when we're in question? We can build up a habit of behaving morally, you know, practicing with the precepts and getting in the habit of just, I know that, you know, for me, there were some precepts when I took them that made a lot of sense, and others that, you know, kind of like, okay, well, whatever. But then gradually over the years, there would be some circumstance where I, you know, kind of went ahead and broke the precept and then like watched the consequences, you know, watched the like, ugh, you know, I thought that was just fine what I did, but now I'm seeing the shit hit the fan, right? So then I gradually became like converted to the precepts. Like, really, I do not want to break the precepts, okay? I know what happens when I break the precepts. So, let's see if there's anything else that I wanted to... Guess that's... Any questions or suggestions for discussion about karma? And I guess maybe I'll just add one more thing with the... In terms of the karma that ends karma, but the karma of practice, I was very encouraged... Early on and really throughout practice, karma just, you can't, the fact that everything you do has an effect, like that's pretty much very hard to question, right? It's just, okay, maybe it's not a big effect, but it has some kind of effect. So for me, that was very encouraging that even though in a way my problems might have seemed very difficult to address or change, like this just said, you just keep, you know, every time you turn your mind in a positive direction, every time you manage to make a slightly different choice, every time you manage to reflect on what just happened a little sooner, you know, it all, like a drop in the bucket, it all will just eventually, you know, add up to something. So I found that source of faith.
I was under the impression, and I'm thinking maybe it's a false impression, that what the Buddha taught was, you know, if you follow the way and you follow the precepts and you behave as much like a bodhisattva as you can, you will not come back after this life. Is that?
No. I mean,
the reason why I like that idea is because it sounded a lot like what Jesus said.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the Buddha's time, I mean, and again, this is original Buddhism. This isn't like Mahayana or Zen, but in original Buddhism, there were four different categories. You know, their stream entry meant that you would eventually be freed from the whole cycle someday. Not saying when. The next one was you were a once returner. You were going to come back one more time. the non-returner was not going to come back to this world, but they were going to be reborn in this kind of liminal kind of heaven realm place to finish what they started. And then they would attain nirvana. And then the arhats that would never come back. And then, there was a whole bunch of people who weren't stream enterers yet, who... And in the Lotus Sutra, which is a Mahayana sutra, there's all the people are asking for their prediction of Buddhahood, and the Buddha's saying, well, many, many, many eons from now, you will be reborn as so-and-so, and then you will attain Buddhahood. And so the idea is that, yeah.
But I just thought the freedom from samsara was the point. And maybe I just misunderstood that. I thought I got that out of some of the books we had to read for the history class years ago.
I mean, so technically they thought people would be coming back many times, but from the Mahayana point of view, so basically if you embrace Buddhism without embracing the doctrine of transmigration, that freedom from samsara is available at any moment. So, basically giving up our desire for things to be different, being with what is there it is. So really in Zen we say, rebirth, what are you thinking about future lives for?
Any
other
question? So what does Buddhism have to say, if anything, about karma for non-human animals?
I guess from the Buddhist point of view, karma is about intentional action. So chances are they would say other animals don't have intention. I don't know that that's true, right? I mean, it's probably more of like a gradation, right? There's probably creatures out there that do have much more of a moral sense than we can imagine. Elephants? I mean, who knows what's going on in there? So, I don't know. I mean, so Buddhism basically hasn't touched it because it's always just kind of written off animals as not having that capacity. But
is part of this transmigration is always one human
to another
human?
No, you can become an animal. So, I mean, in the six realms, are you familiar with the six realms?
I've heard of it before.
Yeah, so like, it's not just heaven and hell, It's like a whole wheel. So there's the upper realms are the human realm, heaven realm, and the realm of the fighting, the Asuras, the realm of the fighting, they're kind of demigods, not quite in heaven, and they're very envious of heaven, so they're always they're just full of jealousy. And then the lower realms are the hungry ghosts, seeking for what they can never. Their thirst and hunger can never be satisfied. The hell realm, which is, what you might imagine. And then the realm of the beasts. I like to say the beast realm, not the animal realm, but because the idea is that in that realm, which of course it can be a metaphor for our own states of mind and being sometimes, in that realm you're just sleeping, eating, sex. It's just kind of really basic, self-centered, sensual concerns. So the idea in that there's a way out of each realm, and out of the beast realm is essentially knowledge. It's essentially learning. It's learning about karma. Waking up to that. So yeah, I mean, in that doctrine of transmigration, for what it's worth, you could be reborn as an animal. And actually, there's stories of the Buddha's previous lives, called the Jataka tales, that have him born as an animal many times. And practice and speaking and making moral decisions as an animal, interestingly enough. So, I guess I guess that belies what I said about Buddhism never seeing animals that way. I don't know. It's a rich, complicated tradition with a lot of different threads.
Causality is fascinating because I tend to think of action as being opposed to inaction, but the more I dig into it, the more it seems like there's no such thing as action, right?
Mm.
What I think of as effects are the causes of other effects. What I think of as causes are the effects of other causes. There's, you know, there's no way to cease to participate.
Mm.
So why is intention special in that web of ceaseless cause and effect?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think different Buddhists would probably, you know, Buddhists of different traditions might answer that a little differently. Because I know in our Zen tradition, intention matters, but it's not the only thing that matters. So we basically say karma is generated. So it's very different if you intentionally kill someone than if you accidentally cause someone's death. You know, the karma is very different. It's a very different situation, but there's karma for both. You know, even if it's just, you know, it wasn't even negligence, but you ended up causing someone's death. That is going to affect you for the rest of your life and have many repercussions. So, like, there is karma generated, it's just the intention flavors it. The intention, you know, changes its trajectory a little bit. And I guess the intention, that's one of the things that we can work on. Maybe that's why there's that emphasis.
The application of will definitely seems to be tangled up in liberation versus not liberation.
But even with specific intention, it's like throwing a pebble in the pond, the ripples go out.
Yeah.
And, you know, trying to use karma as a tool is insane. Because you have no idea what the intention is. You think you do, but that's your thinking. And, you know, you do something, you think it's so good. Something bad happens.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a mystery. Karma, it is. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and one guy said, what you think, what you say, and what you do. That's it. It's karma. The rest of it, bit of a crash.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't have the quote with me, but there's something where the Buddha says there's like, I can't remember, 3 or 5 things that just, like, you'll just go crazy if you contemplate, you know, like how the universe happened, you know, various things like that. And then he says, like, and then the workings of karma, you know, trying to figure out, like, why and how, and, you know, like, you'll just, because it's such a complicated infinite system with all these different inputs. But so in a way, that's not how we don't operate guided by thinking about karma. Yeah, so it, like, all we can do is be guided by, in our practice, right? So then we already have this, like, all right, you know, killing, stealing, lying, bad idea, good thing to avoid, like, so guided by those things, and then that, you know, the intention is all, you know, we'll work on. But then also, working on our wisdom. Like, ignorance is not an excuse. Again, just kind of like intention. I mean, it, you know, your level of ignorance affects what happens. But just saying, well, I didn't know, doesn't undo the karma. So we're always trying to work on clarifying our own minds and hearts and
Is there a distinction between the Hindu understanding of reincarnation and karma? Are they close? Or am I making
sense? Yeah, they may have some different subtleties to the whole doctrine of transmigration, but, you know, both Buddhism and Hinduism just absorbed that at the same time.
I have a question. So I know Buddhism, it teaches the non-self, that there is no self. How does that reconcile itself with you have free will, there's no self?
That's a very good question. Well, it's that, it's not that we have no self, it's that the self doesn't exist the way we think it does. We think of it as this real entity that is operating through our mind, body, and heart, but it doesn't really exist in that way. And yet, even though there's no homunculus in the box is here. The box moves and functions.
So in the view of Buddhism, is there an agent making decisions?
No.
No.
And yet, we're alive. So, even though with our discriminating mind, we say, well, if there's no agent making the decisions, how does it even work? Because in our discriminating mind, we're like, well, there's got to be an agent making decisions.
Well, not necessarily, but then yeah. It might not be free will. I just, I don't know what the name is.
Now you got it. Now, what we talked about, I see that as me. There's no me.
Right. There's no.
Which is the same as. It's how to release the me.
So experientially, you know, this is about actually living. So in a sense, in an absolute philosophical sense, it doesn't matter whether technically it's free versus just an unfolding of past causes and conditions. But experientially, we know that moment where the future is open in front of us. We have that moment where we can say something or not say something, or and that seems like the definition of life, you know? So whether that's free in a philosophical sense, I don't know, but it feels free.
Right. I mean, I'm not trying to get philosophy. I'm thinking more about the practical implications of, like, if you're trying to make good decisions in life, should you act like you have more, moral agency and like there's somebody making decisions?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Yeah. Because that's where we call it the conventional self, right? I mean, I don't pay your bills, you don't brush my teeth, you know? So it's like, yeah, for practical purposes, we have these boundaries and responsibilities and stuff, but there's no essence in the middle of it. And it's actually quite joyful when you embrace and embody and inhabit your self and your life in that lighter way without it, you know, being so much focused on self-concern. It's just like, huh, look, I ended up like this. And also I found when you do make mistakes or you do have shortcomings, it's also not as big a deal, because it's just kind of like, oh, that's interesting. Sorry about that. I'll try to do better, because it's not about, you know, me.
Because conception of there being no self is that the self is a label, which is man, American, 64-year-old. These are all labels, and we all carry these labels.
Constantly.
You lose those labels, and you lose all those labels. You get down to the nothing, there are no labels, then you are at the essence. Whatever it is. It's hard to imagine that. The Buddha apparently could. But when I say there is nothing, obviously there appears there is something here. There's the universe,
yeah,
of which we are part. We are made up of it. But we lose all those labels, all those judgments, all of that, then we are free. So that's kind of how I conceive the no self.
Yeah.
That I can get, but I can't make good sense of karma. I can't disengage my discriminating mind, and I have the same questions that you have. Logically, it doesn't fit.
Basic question: is there anything beyond the discriminating mind? Is that all there is? Right. Just that construct that we make up. Is that reality? Is that all there is out there? Is there something beyond that? I think there's something beyond that. I don't know what it is.
So what do you, try to elucidate where you're...
I guess it's just in this other sense where if... There's other forms of Buddhism where karma seems rather absolute. Everything that happens as a result of your previous karma, then you have no control, right? Because it sounds like hard determinism to me. Where am I?
Everything that happened to you up till now is due to your previous karma.
Up to this moment, but. Ball's already been on, it's already on the track, it's already going to come down and hit whatever's right in front of it, right?
Well, why can't it be that the past has led to this constellation of conditions? That you have this body and mind and you have this personality and you have this way of seeing things and you have blah, blah, blah. I mean, can't karma have brought you up to that point? And there's still be a point of choice here,
yeah,
from going forward. Are you just thinking like now that choice is just going to be conditioned by everything that came before, and therefore it's kind of not free and meaningless?
Exactly. So maybe there's I'm specifically talking about the forms of Buddhism that say what happens is uniquely due to previous circumstances and whatnot. That would feel like it's hard determinism, but if you're kind of saying, there are choice points where it's not, there's something else besides this all-powerful karma that I can
interact with. Well, aside from whatever that theory is, how do you think it works? How do you think, conditioning and causation and all that, but then I guess free will, choice.
I don't know for sure. I don't think anybody, and I would distrust anybody who says they know for 100% sure. It seems like there's been a lot of evidence from physics that it seems that the universe may be deterministic. I remember watching this program, and it talks about if you're walking towards somebody, your slice of space time is different. If you're walking one direction, then your slice of space time is different. Somebody else's direction. So if I'm walking towards some point, this point is 10 billion light years away. My slice of space time actually corresponds with their future, and so. if I could see their future, then that must have already happened. But there'd be somebody over there who could see my future.
One of the things that I just hit upon listening to all that was, if everything is deterministic, what is left? And I think what's left is in here.
I'm not saying that everything is deterministic. I'm saying, you know, it could all be an illusion.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's right. Well, that's kind of the point. It is all an illusion.
Yeah.
You're deluded with all these terms and cells and labels and discriminations that we aren't really seeing the reality. What that reality is hard.
I guess this is what the Buddha talked about, is that, you know, it's crazy making when you really start to try to untangle it in any kind of logical way. It's not just like difficult to understand. It could be that in a way it's just impossible to understand. I mean, which perhaps physics is actually pointing toward, that there's no single way to even look at it. I mean, it's just not something that you can understand. But the question is, you know, then how do we live? And it sure seems like there's ways to live skillfully and ways not to.
Yeah, I fully believe that, you know, even if it is an illusion, like, we should assume that we have free will because it's kind of necessary.
Yeah, maybe it's part of the package. Maybe we just, like, that's part of the beauty of humans. Isn't that cute? They think that they know what they think they're free, you know? But in a way, that's part of, you know, we probably act very differently if we do think that we're free. So, I don't know, that's an interesting thing to contemplate. Better to just go ahead and believe we're free. I don't know, I felt like I was a very skeptical person, you know, I wanted things to be proven. That's why, you know, why I left Christianity, because I'm just like, I just can't swallow it. You know, I actually need some evidence. You know, and even the stories of, you know, Zen ancestors and Dogen and whatever, it wasn't until I was in Japan, in a museum, looking at Dogen's Kechi Miyaku, written on silk, this document that shows all the ancestors from Shakyamuni with the line, the same thing that we give to people at Jukai. And there was, you know, and of course I couldn't read it, it was Chinese, but I'm trusting that, you know, it said, you know, Rujing, Tentong Rujing, and then Ehe Dogen. And like, it was only when I like saw that, I mean, I stood there in front of it and like cried for 10 minutes because it was like, this is real. I mean, I totally would have been the doubting Thomas. Like, I'm sorry, I don't know. It looks like you got holes in your hands, but you know, can I actually touch them? Because it could just be like an illusion. I would totally have been like the doubting Thomas. I need the evidence. But then at some point I was like, I wrote this poem to myself about being a skeptic, kind of sitting on the sidelines, like, yeah, well, I don't know. I'm not going to be a sucker. Like, you know, that's... And then just picturing, like, people who just... I don't know. They just embrace the faith and are dancing and celebrating. And they're like, okay, that's fine. But while you're, you know, sitting on the sidelines questioning things, you know, we're out living. And I was like, I don't know. Maybe I'll just go for it. I might end up being like you know, like a fool, like an idiot. I might end up being an idiot. I might end up being shown
and
to be wrong.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's just the ego.
This reminds me.
I don't want to look bad.
I'm sitting here, and I'm not a mathematician, but I did do some reading on Pascal's wager. And at the time that he lived, in the 17th century, I think, betting was a big thing. That's what everybody did. This is how they spent their time. They bet and won and lost and all this stuff. And if I have it correct, he said, he was a believer, and he said, you guys, you got to be betting on God. You've got to bet that he exists, because when you die and you find out that he exists, you won. And if you die and you find out that he didn't really exist at all, what difference is it? So, you know, that's
a good...
Be happy.
We die before we die. That's, I think, in the Buddhist tradition. That's what I was taught by a former teacher, is it's just our body, because we let go of the ego and the self. So we really die. Before we die. Larry taught us that. Interesting
way to put it. Not a way that I would have put it, but
yeah,
it sounds a little grim, but
but no, it's related to letting go of the me and the selfish and the ego and finding our
I know, but in my experience that's just like more alive. I don't know. So I don't think of it as dying. I think of it as like opening up to life.
Oh, sure. Yes. Right. So.
Same thing, different words.
Right. It's our path.
Well, it's 9:00. That was an interesting discussion. Thank you all.